Today, on this episode of the PeerDirect Special Spotlight.
One of the highlights was a late breaker, and it was a first look in a phase 3 randomized clinical trial of pirtobrutinib, and this was the Bruin CLL-313 study.
Today, Drs. Weirda and O'Brien joined the podcast to discuss CLL at ASH 2025, Bruin studies, and a triplet for Richter transformation in this PeerDirect Specialist Spotlight. All opinions expressed are those of the presenters and do not necessarily reflect the views of this educational initiative's supporters.
Hello, I'm Dr. William Weirda, Professor of Medicine in the Department of Leukemia at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston.
And I'm Dr. Susan O'Brien, Professor of Medicine in the Division of Hematology Oncology at the University of California Irvine School of Medicine.
Thanks for joining me, Susan.
It's my pleasure to be here, Bill.
We're here at the American Society of Hematology annual meeting in Orlando, and we've seen quite a few potentially practice-changing CLL presentations. Why don't we discuss a few of these? One of the highlights was a late breaker, and it was a first look in a phase 3 randomized clinical trial of pirtobrutinib, and this was the Bruin CLL-313 study with the non-covalent BTK inhibitor pirtobrutinib in the frontline setting versus chemoimmunotherapy.
Yeah, so this was a phase 3 randomized trial, and it was comparing pirtobrutinib to sort of a standard of chemoimmunotherapy, which is bendamustine and rituximab, or BR. Now, this trial did exclude patients with 17p deletion because really we know it's not really fair to give those patients chemoimmunotherapy. So because that was the control arm, these patients were excluded. And it was a fairly good-sized study with about 282 patients randomized, with the primary endpoint being the PFS. And indeed, we saw the pirtobrutinib showed a highly significant PFS improvement over BR. The rates at 2 years were 93.4% versus 70.7% with BR. And the benefit went to those who were mutated as well as those who were unmutated. And I would say the overall survival is really pretty much too early.
I agree. It's an early look, but it's comparing a continuous small molecule inhibitor, BTK inhibitor, against chemoimmunotherapy. And so we know that chemoimmunotherapy will result in short progression-free survival, but at this time point, it certainly looks and clearly looks superior. Pirtobrutinib looks superior over bendamustine and rituximab. I think the other thing to talk about is safety and the reported grade 3 or greater treatment-emergent adverse events. For pirtobrutinib was 40%. For bendamustine was higher at 67.4%. Only 4.3% of patients discontinued pirtobrutinib in the follow-up that was available, while 15% discontinued the bendamustine and rituximab. There was a very low incidence of atrial fibrillation at 1.4%, which was 2 patients with pirtobrutinib. Okay, sticking with the pirtobrutinib theme, a group that I've been involved with presented data for the Bruin CLL-314 study, which is a head-to-head comparison in a phase 3 trial of ibrutinib versus pirtobrutinib. And that trial included both treatment-naive patients and previously treated patients. This is referred to as the Bruin CLL-314 trial. And could you perhaps review with us the results from that trial?
Yeah, this was a pretty big trial, over 600 patients randomized 1-to-1, and about a third of the patients were treatment naive, and the other group was relapsed or refractory. And the trial met its primary endpoint, which was non-inferiority, and in actuality, there was a trend for improvement with pirtobrutinib, not just non-inferiority. Overall response rate in the whole population was higher, and it was higher in both the relapsed refractory patients, being 84% with pirto versus 75% with ibrutinib. In the treatment naive subset, it was also higher at 93% versus about 86%. And the PFS was still kind of early, but the hazard ratio was also favoring pirtobrutinib across all of the subgroups.
And in terms of safety, the incidence of atrial fibrillation was 2.4% among those patients who received pirtobrutinib versus 13.5% for those patients who received ibrutinib. Now, we know ibrutinib is associated with a higher incidence of atrial fibrillation in the randomized trials comparing the second generation covalent BTK inhibitors. This is data that demonstrates also that it is higher among patients who received ibrutinib versus the non-covalent BTK inhibitor, pirtobrutinib. Hypertension can be an issue with the BTK inhibitors, and the incidence of hypertension for those patients who received pirtobrutinib was 10.6% versus 15.1% for those patients who received ibrutinib. And we also know that with the BTK inhibitors, while the incidence of hypertension might be relatively low early on during treatment, we can see increases in the incidence of hypertension as patients remain on treatment beyond several years. There were fewer dose reductions for patients who received the pirtobrutinib. So I think both of these studies are very, very important, particularly with regard to the frontline therapy of patients with chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and particularly with regard to the continuous BTK inhibitor based therapy. I'm curious about your thoughts on what the clinical implications are and how this might be used in practice-changing data.
Well, I think for sure what we know is that this will give pirtobrutinib a frontline indication. I'm sure they will get that indication from the FDA based on both trials, in particular the large trial comparing it to BR. I think the big question is going to be, since we know that pirtobrutinib works so well in patients who develop resistance to the covalent BTK inhibitors, do you want to use it up front or do you want to wait? I think the unanswered question, of course, is if you do use it up front and patients become resistant to pirtobrutinib, can we go back and use the covalent inhibitors? And of course, we have no data on that. So what would be the attraction of moving it up front? Clearly the safety profile. I mean, you pointed out the really dramatic difference in atrial fibrillation rates. And although you pointed out that the hypertension rates were somewhat lower with pirto, not greatly lower, you also made the very important point that we know with ibrutinib, those rates of hypertension are going to go up significantly over time. Now, to be fair, we don't know that that's not going to happen with pirto, but it could be that the rates of hypertension get even more different as time goes on. And then I think the safety profile would make the physician maybe want to move it up. But again, there's this question of, well, or can we go back to the covalent inhibitor? So we really, I don't think, have an answer to that.
And I would add to that as well, we don't know the answer to that. We know that patients with CLL, the median age at diagnosis is 72. Most of them don't need treatment when they're initially diagnosed. The median age probably when patients initiate therapy is 75 or older. And the expected duration of response with these agents and what we know from only ibrutinib now, because we need a longer follow-up for the second generation covalent BTK inhibitors, for ibrutinib, the median PFS is 9 years. And so you can have patients, elderly patients, patients over 75 in particular, who may only need one treatment during their lifetime. And so sequencing becomes less relevant in that setting. What are your thoughts on randomized trials with chemoimmunotherapy as a control arm? Is this the last trial we expect to see with chemotherapy as the comparator?
That's a great question. I mean, you know as well as I do that in the U.S., for the most part, we don't use chemoimmunotherapy anymore. I think that's a fair statement. But if I want to take a more global view, I will say that, in other parts of the world, particularly due to financial concerns, chemoimmunotherapy still is the standard of care. So I guess if the company wants their drug approved more widely, we still might see a randomization to chemoimmunotherapy, but I think the U.S. would likely be participating less and less in those type of trials.
So let's change direction a bit and talk about a study in a population of very high risk and unmet need, and that's patients who develop Richter transformation. At MD Anderson, we initiated a trial of triplet therapy for patients with Richter transformation, particularly the DLBCL Richter transformation. Would you mind summarizing that abstract for us?
Yeah, I thought it was really, really encouraging. I mean, as you said, this is a really high-risk group, and we've tried many different regimens in these people, and they always do very poorly with median survivals, generally less than 1 year. And this was a small study so far. Are you continuing to accrue to that study, Bill?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, so we had about, you had about 12 patients with a high-risk biology, as we know, Richter's tend to have. So about 70% of these patients had a TP53 abnormality. Almost 90% were unmutated, as expected. It's the more refractory CLL patients that go on to develop Richter's transformation. And I believe in this study they could get up to 25 cycles with an optional extension. And what was encouraging is a complete metabolic response, meaning complete resolution of the large cell component at least, was seen in 7 of the 12 patients with one partial metabolic resolution, and maybe that patient's continuing on therapy and might achieve a complete molecular response. So that's a pretty high overall response rate of 67%. And I think the depth of emission was quite high, right, Bill?
Yes. We looked at MRD for patients on this study, and at cycle 7, 6 out of 7 had undetectable MRD4 by flow cytometry, and at the end of cycle 13, all patients were undetectable among the 6 that we were able to test. The survival actually is the most impressive part of this study for me. We studied pirtobrutinib monotherapy for patients with Richter's transformation. That was a sponsored study by Lilly, and we reported what I felt was a very high response rate for monotherapy with pirtobrutinib. I believe it was 50 to 60% with monotherapy. Now, the disappointing part of that trial, and there were 80 patients who were treated on that trial, the disappointing part of that trial was the duration of response. The median PFS on that trial with pirto monotherapy was only 3 months. And so what we've reported so far for this trial has been a more impressive progression-free survival and event-free survival. Would you mind reviewing those data for us?
Yeah, your EFS was 73%, and the one-year overall survival was 82%. And as I made the comment earlier, you know, you almost never see a survival over 1 year in Richter. So to have 82% alive at that point is really, really impressive. And I know a couple of people went to transplant, and I think we generally do try to get all these patients to go to transplant, but a lot of them are older or have a lot of comorbidities that make that not possible. So the point I'm making is that there were only a couple that went to transplant. So most of these remissions are, I won't say unsustained because they continue on therapy, but they're not patients who went to transplant and were cured. So I think that that's really, really impressive. And I think this is, if I'm not mistaken, Bill, I think this is the best data I've seen for any regimen in Richter's.
In my opinion, it is, but I would emphasize your point that you made earlier, and that it's a small cohort of patients. So far, 12 that we reported in the abstract, the presentation was updated with, I think, 3 more patients. And we continue to enroll on this patient, this trial. The trial was intended to enroll a total of 20 patients, but I think if we continue to see the results that we've been seeing, it'll probably be expanded beyond that. It's hard to do randomized phase 3 trials in patients with Richter's transformation. Fortunately, my opinion is that the incidence of Richter's is lower in the era of patients not receiving chemotherapy for their CLL. I'd be interested in knowing what your opinion is about that.
I totally agree. I'm not sure I've actually seen data published that says that, but it's certainly my anecdotal experience. And in talking to other people who treat a lot of CLL, I think we all kind of share that impression that luckily we're not seeing it. Presumably, not using chemoimmunotherapy does less DNA damage, and so we are less likely to get transformation. But nevertheless, there's still these patients do develop Richter's, and then they're a real unmet medical need for sure. One of the biggest unmet medical needs that we still have in CLL.
Absolutely. Well, Susan, that's about all the time we have for this segment. I want to thank you for this great conversation, and thank you also for your great insights.
It's been my pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
And thank you to our audience. Please watch the additional videos in this series, where we'll explore more CLL news from ASH 2025.
And that's today's special spotlight. Thank you for joining us for this episode of PeerDirect Medical News Podcast. For more stories like these, visit us at peerdirect.com. Thoughts, comments, or suggestions? Please leave us a review in your preferred listening platform or email us at editorial@peerdirect.com. Listen and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also download our Amazon Alexa Flash Briefing Medical News Roundup and just ask, "What's my flash briefing?" Thanks today to our guest, Drs. Weirda and O'Brien. Join me next time for an episode where we cover the latest stories in the world of medicine.